The first half of 2016 has been interesting for strange weather in Alaska. Little to no snow last winter, a warm, dry spring, some unusually hot temperatures, and fears of a huge wildfire season then gave way to torrential rain, flooding, and mudslides. What can we expect for this fall and winter? We're talking about the weather and the long-term relationship to a changing climate. Today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. The flood control system for the Chena River has been getting a workout, and flooding and erosion on the Matanuska River in the Matsu Valley is causing a lot of stress for riverbank homeowners and borough officials. Is this a cranky La Nina coming in, or El Nino throwing a tantrum on the way out? Fortunately, we've got two experts on tap today to help us understand why the weather has been wacky for the more than first half of 2016 and what we might expect for the rest of the year based on climate. Brian Brett Snyder is an Anchorage-based climatologist and is in the studio with me here. Hi, Brian.
Good morning, Lori.
Thanks so much for being here. And Rick Toman works for NOAA in Fairbanks and is also a climate expert, a climatologist. Rick joins us from the studio of our partners, KUAC. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. Great to be here.
All right. Thanks so much. And you know, I'm going to indulge myself for just a moment before I give out the phone numbers. Today is my big brother's birthday. He's listening in Wrangell, or he better be. So happy birthday, bro. You're always going to be older than me. If you want to join our conversation today on Talk of Alaska about weather and climate, the numbers are 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org. First, let's Brian and Rick, and Rick, maybe you can take the lead on this. Give us an update on the storm that is in the high Arctic. What's going on, and what might it portend for the Arctic sea ice?
Well, we've had a very deep storm move across the very high Arctic, less than 500 miles from the North Pole. It's one of a series of storms that's been moving across near the pole on the Pacific side, and a lot of wind and a lot of cold air with wrapping around that storm. The main impact from that is not going to be Alaska. This center of this storm is more than 1,000 miles north of Barrow. But the with all the wind around that storm, it's really going to move sea ice around, and there is the potential for it to really open up some water and allow for significant melt at very high latitude, possibly similar to what we saw with a very deep storm in August of 2012.
Today, the Crystal Serenity, an enormous cruise ship, is taking off from Seward. It's the first big ship to attempt travel up through the Arctic and then to New York. Is there any concern at all? This big storm, is it too far away to have any impact in this setting? Rick, Brian?
excuse me. Well, I'm not sure what the schedule is for the Crystal Serenity, when it's going to be rounding through the Bering Sea and making it onto the to the North Slope and points beyond. It would be unlikely to be impacted by the current storm. And if anything, you know, the storm with the winds would break up the ice. I would hypothesize that it would perhaps make the ice part of the voyage easier, perhaps not the for large swells. But as Rick has noted, there's been a parade of storms, and so it might make for some unpleasant sailing if another storm comes in on the heels of the current one.
When storms like that impact the Arctic sea ice and bust it up, turn it into a giant Arctic slushy, what does that mean as far as then the feedback loop is warming and increasing? Does that create conditions for more storms?
Well, one of the big fears with melting sea ice in the Arctic is that it basically opens up a reservoir for warming. Open water is about 8 to 10 times more efficient at absorbing solar energy. When it's ice covered, it's almost like a mirror. But when it's open, the absorptive capabilities of the water are very high. So when you remove that ice, it absorbs the warmth, and then by extension, with Alaska right near the this open water, Alaska then becomes quite a bit warmer. And with the storms that are moving over the sea ice and breaking up the ice, it increases the surface area of the ice and makes it much more prone to melting. So think of a glass of water with ice cubes versus a glass with crushed ice. With the crushed ice, it'll actually melt quite a bit faster, and the ice cubes will stay a lot longer. So when you put a big storm over that sea ice, it basically turns it into crushed ice instead of solid ice.
Rick, this is a question that might show how naive I am about some of this stuff, but that's okay. How difficult, or is it difficult, to predict storms in an area of the Arctic that is so incredibly remote? Last week we had Bill Strever on talking about his book on wind, and part of the book is the history of meteorology. He talked about weather ships and how there used to be more than 7,000 ships that helped gather information, eyeballs right there in the oceans. And there's less than half that number now. And certainly there's no ships cruising around up there that are gathering this information. I understand that we have satellites, but Rick, is it more difficult to know what's happening in an area that's so vast and so remote?
Well, it is certainly very difficult. Satellites help. There's actually quite a large international effort to gather observations in the high Arctic, not just for the for understanding what's happening in the Arctic and being able to predict that, but also it feeds into what many people outside of Alaska are much more concerned about, of course, the impacts of a changing Arctic on the middle latitudes. And even with the efforts that we have seen in the last few decades, of course, the Arctic remains very poorly sampled. It's difficult to know what's going on. When it comes to weather models, things like how chunked up the ice is, how much is it like a slushy and how much is it like a sheet, those things are almost completely unknown at the weather scale level. And so, for instance, the ongoing storm appears to have been significantly deeper than most of the global numerical weather models forecast. That's not unexpected because they do not really, the models don't really know just the fraction of water versus ice at the detail necessary to get a good handle on those storms.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are discussing climate and weather. We're going to start localizing it soon. Our call-in numbers, if you have questions or comments about what you've observed in this, especially in the last several months, 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide, 1-800-478-8255, or in Anchorage, 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. The heavy rainfall that has caused flooding, the Chena River Lakes flood control system has been getting a workout this month, and in the Mat-Su Valley, homeowners along the Matanuska River are watching it devour chunks of the riverbank. What's the latest on flooding concerns in the state, and what can you tell us about how wet the fall may be? Brian, let's start with you.
Well, there's a for the Matanuska River, a lot of the flow, especially the summertime flow in the Matanuska River, is comes from glacial runoff. And so it's there's a disconnect in many ways between, you know, the amount of rain we've seen and the overall atmospheric pattern versus what the flow is of the river. So that's important to keep in mind. As far as for the interior, you know, there was many large portions of Alaska were at 200 and 300% of their normal rainfall for June, July, the June-July period, and July just by itself. And, you know, that really swelled the rivers. Now, it's the rivers really did a good job. There wasn't a whole lot of flooding concerns. Of course, the Chena flood control project was activated in the Fairbanks area, and Rick can speak much better to that about how that reduced the flows and reduced the impacts to the city of Fairbanks. But there was rivers around the state are high, but they very 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 few of them have actually exceeded their flood stage.
Rick, tell us a little bit about the latest with the Chena River Lakes flood control project. Are the gates open now? What's happening currently?
So the gates have been open for some days now. We've had somewhat of a change in weather pattern from what we had for much of July and into the first days of August, where we had a very moist, wet flow coming out of the west and southwest across mainland Alaska. It's changed somewhat since then, especially for the interior. So we're not seeing the high rainfall amounts and the big large-scale storms that we had during July. There's still plenty of showers around, but in general, rainfall amounts are significantly lower in the last week, and that's greatly helping the river situation. But as Brian mentioned, it's been so wet all summer. Ground in many areas, especially in the southern and eastern interior, are very saturated or very wet compared to normal. So this is likely to be an issue until freeze up.
How important is that control project, the Chena River Lakes Dam, you know, the mitigation, flooding mitigation system? If that was not in place, what would Fairbanks be experiencing right now?
Well, Fairbanks would certainly have a lot higher water than we've had in town. There is actually substantial flow into the Chena River from below the project. The Little Chena River, for instance, flows in to the Chena below the project. But without that, there would have been at least some flooding all the way, you know, all the way into town. But with that diversion, with these very high flows, town is for the most part protected. It is actually possible that Fairbanks could still flood from input from below the dam, but it would require rain like the 1967 deluge that was really the impetus for the construction of the Moose Creek Flood Control Project.
When the flood control project was built, how much use did it get past that time until currently?
Well, it has been activated on occasion, although there's been long stretches, years at a time, when it was not necessary to activate it. But it has certainly saved Fairbanks's proverbial bacon on numerous occasions. This summer, as Brian mentioned, kind of interesting in that we've had extremely high rainfall amounts, but even above the flood control project on the Chena, there's been high water, but generally not severe flooding. And that's in part reflecting that the high rainfall amounts in part have come over a long period of time as opposed to just one or two storms. But certainly since the flood control project was built, Fairbanks is much less likely to have widespread flooding problems, as was so common before 1967.
If you've got some weather observations or are noticing changes that you would like to ask questions about and want to know if it's linked to climate, you can give us a call, or if you just have a question for our climate experts that we have today with us in the studios at Alaska Public Media and in KUAC in Fairbanks. Give us a call, 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-TALK is the number statewide. 550-8422. 550-8422 is the number in Anchorage. And you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Has there been a change in the annual precipitation rate? Is it climbing? How much do warmer sea temperatures affect rainfall here? And is that having a kind of a impact on what we're seeing for the trajectory for rainfall, annual rainfall?
Well, the last few years, certainly, most of the last 10 years, I believe, have seen above normal precipitation, but not all. And they none of them are in the top handful of record years. In theory, when you have a warming climate, when you have sea surface temperatures surrounding Alaska that are significantly above normal, it provides a source of additional moisture. So, for example, the sea surface temperatures in the Gulf of Alaska are several degrees warmer than normal, and that air, that moist air, is available for storms to access. And if you have a system where you have all things being equal, like atmospheric dynamics being equal, if you have X amount of moisture 1 year, and then that increases by 5 or 10% with the warmer sea surface temperatures, then you are likely to get more precipitation. But an important caveat of that is that same atmospheric dynamics. So there's not always a one-to-one correlation. So in some cases, with a warming climate, that may affect circulation patterns, and it may affect where storms form and the intensity and the rate at which storms form. So again, there's not that one-to-one correlation. But in terms of this year in 2016, they send off weather balloons in, I believe, 14 different places around Alaska, and most every one of those balloon stations east of the west coast of Alaska had one of their top one or two years on record for atmospheric moisture. And so again, that's kind of priming the pump. If there's a storm that can squeeze out that moisture, then you would expect more moisture to fall. And then at the lowest levels at the surface, what we feel as humidity, the physical amount of moisture in the air this year compared to a typical year is about 10% higher in both Anchorage and Fairbanks. So the reservoir of moisture has been particularly high this year, and you would expect it to stay high in a warming climate with warming oceans. But again, it's a matter of what the atmosphere, can it access that moisture? Can it squeeze it out? And that's still an open question.
That's interesting. You were talking about the elevated humidity. I've noticed so many more low-hanging bands of clouds around Anchorage. And when I moved here 16, 17 years ago, we didn't see that very often. And it just seems like we've seen a lot of that this year. And last year, I also noticed quite a bit of it. Rick, did you want to add to Brian's comments?
No, I think you covered it well. Maybe one point I would add, we see this not just in Alaska, but anywhere. Once it gets wet and the ground is wet, vegetation is wet, can potentially become a self-sustaining process. You've got more water at the surface and on plants, and that gets to evaporate, and then that adds moisture to the atmosphere, which can then be immediately returned in the form of more rains. So this kind of recycling of the local moisture or regional moisture is potentially very important. And I'm pretty confident we've seen that to some extent in the interior, where it's very wet, lots of moisture available to be evaporated, and then it gets quickly returned. Important source of moisture this time of year, not just Alaska, but anywhere that's got very wet ground.
And with earlier green up, I know Rick has noted in the past, especially in the interior, there's a large spike in moisture availability, right as soon as green up happens, and that's been occurring on average, not every year, but on average earlier over time. And so that kind of length also lengthens the period potentially that that heavier precipitation might occur.
You know, I'm really glad that you both have raised that issue of sort of self-perpetuating weather, because I did want to ask about that. When it's when conditions are very, very hot and dry, is it harder for moisture systems to move into an area? Can that sort of self-feedback loop happen on both sides, Brian?
Well, you know, I know in the lower 48, there's a lot of talk with, especially during severe droughts, when there's the soil gets completely dried out, and then that becomes a limiting factor for new precipitation to fall, because it's not available in the soil to evaporate out and to seed clouds. That in and of itself is less of an issue in Alaska, because our evaporation rates are generally, on average, quite a bit lower. But I think especially with temperatures, and also precipitation, but in terms of temperatures, you have situations where you need a certain number, you know, as temperatures rise in the afternoon, they slowly cool off all night long. And so if you're raising, you know, if it's clear, if there's less moisture in the air potentially, you're raising that temperature during the day, and it just doesn't have enough time to recover at night. So you're starting the next day at a slightly higher baseline.
We're talking about climate and weather, and we have climatologist Brian Bratschneider in the studio in Anchorage with me, and Rick Toman, NOAA climatologist in KUAC's studio in Fairbanks, joining us by ISDN. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Ard is in Wasilla. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I promised the screener that I would try to be pointed and brief, and I'll do so. I'm not well-versed enough to discuss, you know, the hydrologic cycle and the ability for high or low-pressure fronts and zones to maintain their presence over South Central. What I have noticed over the past 7 years is an increasing number, not a number in the aircraft themselves, but the presence of a number, sometimes 4 to 6, of very high-flying aircraft. I do know what a contrail is. I do understand the concept of condensation from the exhaust from jet engines, and the normal contrail dissipates and evaporates in the upper atmosphere. These planes that we have flying over Alaska emit a trail that eventually spreads out into a milky film over the blue sky. When we have blue sky, like today, we have some clouds up there, puffy-looking clouds out here in the valley. I don't know if it'll happen today. There's no way to set your watch by it. But these aircraft emit a film that seems to connect all of the clouds and cover us. Now, a little background. I'll be 62 years old soon. I've been around a while. I've always been an outdoorsman. I watch birds and hawks, so I look up in the sky a lot. And this is a phenomenon that has been increasing over the years, and it does, in fact, turn a sunny day. If all the residents of Alaska who are listening to the program began to cast an eye to the sky and study this, it will turn a sunny day into a kind of milky sky, semi-overcast.
So do you have a question linked to this?
Well, this is more or less just a heads up to everyone listening to the program to cast an eye to the sky and see if I am the only person in the state who notices this. And to the climatologists on board, is it possible that this is in some way influencing our weather?
All right. Well, thank you for the question, Art. And Brian, would you like to respond to this? I have heard this concern expressed from others, so let's give him some good scientific information here.
Well, let me start with some the real science, and that is that, you know, if the jet contrails do produce something similar to a wispy cloud, and there is a little bit of evidence that can actually reduce the amount of solar energy coming in. And I think there was a study after 9/11 when the planes were grounded for 3 days that there was a very slight increase in temperature when there was no jet contrails around
really?
The
interesting
over the lower 48 anyway. I don't know if it was a global study. But as far as what the caller is referring to is chemtrails, and that is it's basically a conspiracy theory that there is chemicals being released as in some of the versions of the conspiracy as mind control agents and as weather modification agents. And actually this week in the journal Environmental Research Letters, they published a study where they asked, you know, the serious scientists, you know, is this real? Is this even possible? And it was uniformly rejected. Now, I know Rick works for the Weather Service, and they get questions all the time from people who are really concerned about this. And you know, I don't want to be dismissive of people and their legitimate concerns, but it really is nothing more than a conspiracy theory that has absolutely zero basis in science. It's not happening. And if someone tells you that there is a chemtrail conspiracy, you're probably not going to convince them otherwise, but there's not.
All right. Well, we got the answer there. Thanks for the call. Let's go back to the phone lines. Ron is in Fairbanks. Hi, Ron.
Hi, good morning. I had a question about how we need to conceptualize the atmospheric moisture, whether it's global or regional. The reason I raise that is I've been reading a lot about all of the aquifers globally that are being depleted. We know the Ogallala one in the Midwest is having problems. We know that the Brahmaputra off the Ganges is being depleted. They're having terrible droughts there. Arabian Peninsula aquifer is being drained. And in Australia, the Canning Basin is being drained. And we know that because they're having horrible fires and droughts in those areas. But what happens to that water once it is depleted over many generations? Does that change the global weather?
Well, I think perhaps what you're getting at is you know, these aquifers take, in many cases, especially in desert areas, thousands of years to fill up. And if you're using that water for irrigation, if you're pumping it out of the ground and you're putting it on cropland, is that gonna increase the atmospheric moisture profile? And I guess it would, on a local scale, it would stand to reason. I'm not sure, you could do the math on the amount of water taken out of these aquifers and how much that would add to the global atmosphere. My guess would be a little, but not a lot, but I can't be that for sure about that until I would take a calculator out.
Yeah, it's interesting because they are on such a large scale globally, and they've been happening very slowly. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what the cumulative effect would be if we assume the Earth is on a closed system.
That is an interesting question. I'm glad you brought that up.
Thanks for the call, Ron. Rick, did you want to jump in and add to Brian's comments here?
Just to stress that locally, this is where this water is used for irrigation, which is, of course, a common use of aquifer pump water. Locally, that certainly will increase the near surface moisture available. Instead of being underground, it's at the surface and is able to be evaporated and transpired by plants. So on a very local level, the answer is definitively yes. As Brian indicated, it's not likely to be a significant issue on the continental or global scale.
Well, thanks for the call. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have more conversations with our climate experts and take your calls as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing a changing climate and impacts on weather. We have climate experts Brian Brettschneider in the Anchorage studio and Rick Toman in KUAC's studio in Fairbanks. And Rick, we have a question, an email question from Tom in Fairbanks. So I'm going to direct this toward you. Has Fairbanks been windier in recent years? If so, how unusual is it? Or have there been similar windy times? Rick, is it windier in Fairbanks?
Well, that is, it's actually one of the most common questions that we get. And it's actually very difficult to answer. The short answer is not that we can tell. The longer answer is that wind measurements have actually varied greatly over the years. And because wind speeds increase on average very dramatically in the lowest 100 feet above the ground, it matters very much the exact height that your wind measuring equipment is at, and as well as things like any nearby trees or buildings or anything like that. For instance, in Fairbanks, most of the high wind records, or many of them, were set during the 1940s and 50s. But if you look, you'll find that, in fact, during that era, it was standard procedure to put wind equipment on at airports on the rotating beacon towers 70 to 100 feet up. And that's going to give much different wind measurements than the current standard, which is about 33 feet, 10 meters up. I would love to be able to answer that question at the instrumental level, but because of these differences, it's very it's really hard to make any kind of statements like that. We can use computer models to get a more general answer, and when we do that, the answer is there's no statistically significant increase in winds in the last few decades.
All right, thanks for that, Rick. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Trevor is in Healy. Hi, Trevor.
Hi.
Do you have a question?
I got a comment for Rick. How are you doing, Rick?
Great.
You on Colby Hill, you remember me, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm telling, I got some observations here. You know this country, and in 30 years of watching the weather and measuring, I noticed one thing. Last fall was the actual saturation point here where I am. And then another thing that you guys haven't talked about yet is all the forest fires. I had an 8,800-acre fire here on Colby Hill in 2012, and that was a lot of tall white spruce. And because of the lack of vegetation, we're not only getting the erosion, but all that water isn't being used up by the vegetation, and it's going down into the drainage areas. And where I am, my average precip annually is 10 inches. And in the last year, just about exactly, I'm at 23 3/4 inches, so I'm more than double.
Wow.
And I have never dried out since we flooded last fall, last August. I think I got 5.5 inches here. But anyway, Rick can comment on this. He knows the area, and we're talking double the rainfall and all the fires all around this state. I mean, that water has to go somewhere, and it's going down into the drainages.
All right, Trevor, thanks so much for the call.
Yep.
Rick, comment on the extreme rainfall?
It's been incredibly wet. 2014 was in parts of mainland Alaska even wetter than this summer. Some places have been wetter this summer, but with two of the last 3 years have been really wet. And as Trevor mentioned, part of last summer in the interior was also wet. And but we don't have to go back too far to find some pretty dry weather. For instance, many of you will remember hot, dry 2009, hot, dry 2013, especially early in the summer. So we certainly, on the short time, great observation that it's been wet and it's never really been able to dry out. And that's an important point. When we look at the decades and longer time scale, certainly some of this just by the nature of the atmosphere, is going to be chalked up to random variation, and especially with precipitation, because it is so variable. As Trevor pointed out, 200% of normal, twice normal. That's a lot. Because of that big variability, very difficult to pick out long-term trends when just by random chance it can vary by so much.
This is Talk of Alaska. We are discussing climate and the impacts on our weather. You can join our conversation if you have a question or a comment at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. You can call 550-8422 if you're in the Anchorage area, 550-8422, or email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. There was a big warm water anomaly called, scientists dubbed the blob, in the Pacific. How big, how warm, and what kind of impact has it had? And is it still around? Is it still a blob? Is it unblobbed? What's happening? Brian?
Well, the blob, as many of the listeners know, was a very large, anomalously warm area of water, you know, in the Gulf of Alaska, and then down off of southeast and toward the Pacific Northwest of the lower 48. Rick is actually much more in tune with what the latest is on the blob, so I'll defer to him. But I do know that it has been waning out, but I don't believe it's gone yet. Rick?
So, yeah, so the blob came to, got its 15 minutes of glory in 2013-14, and it was certainly part of the same phenomena that brought us the extremely warm weather during part of that winter. Since then, the blob, to some ways, has kind of morphed. Initially, it was kind of in the central Gulf of Alaska and point south, and then moved eastward to the North American coast. And it's kind of morphed into many listeners will be familiar with, this Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is refers to a pattern of sea surface temperature anomalies across the Pacific. When it's in what we call the positive phase, sea surface temperatures near Alaska and the western coast of North America are above normal, while there's cooler than average water across the north central Pacific, kind of south of the Aleutians. So to some extent, the blob has just morphed into our friend, the positive PDO. But there's more to the story than that. The water has been so warm in the Northeast Pacific for so long that heat now extends down hundreds of meters below the surface. So it's not just that the surface is warm. There's a lot of excess heat buildup in the Northeast Pacific that extends down very deep. So I would make the claim that a blob lives, but it's gone to depth now.
A sneakier blob. What does that mean for the end of, or does the blob have any impact on what we're seeing with sort of the end of El Nino and maybe the start of La Nina? Brian, where are we at in that cycle?
Well, again, as many listeners know, we just finished, or we're now out of what was one of the very strongest El Ninos on record. And an El Nino is defined by temperatures in the central tropical Pacific Ocean. And those turn out to be very important with the movement of atmospheric energy and can affect weather patterns globally. So El Nino is gone, and the temperatures are actually now about a half degree Celsius below normal in that region of the Pacific. If that is maintained for some period of time, we would then call it a La Nina, which would be the opposite. And the trade winds switch directions, and that the transfer of heat in the atmosphere changes, and there's a lot of atmospheric responses. So we're not in La Nina yet. It takes a long time. It has to be, I think, five consecutive 3-month overlapping periods of half degree Celsius. I may not have that exactly correct. But the latest forecast is, I believe, a 60% chance that we will enter La Nina, and that would be generally a fairly weak La Nina. So, but as Rick mentioned, there's this incredible reservoir of heat stored in the northern Pacific Ocean, in the Gulf of Alaska, basically the water surrounding Alaska. And there's a thermal inertia. It just takes a long time for that to dissipate. So even if, you know, even if the atmosphere, in a sense, wanted to cool off, there's this, again, there's all this heat that's surrounding Alaska. So that's just going to take time to work off. And hopefully, you know, that happens sooner rather than later. But with that, again, with all that heat, it's really hard to imagine Alaska kind of transitioning more toward normal, even below normal temperatures.
So what does that portend for precipitation moving into the fall? Are we going to see some snow this winter?
Well, that's really hard to say. The El Niño and La Niña, the relationships with temperatures are much more pronounced and reliable over the winter, not so much over the summer, but winter. Precipitation is really hit or miss, so it's hard to say. Now, last winter, for example, most listeners might not realize it was actually quite a wet winter, even though it wasn't very snowy. If you went to elevation, there was a lot of snow and avalanches, and there were several avalanche fatalities in South Central. But down here near sea level, a different story, a lot of more rain and more downsloping off the Chugach Mountains. So, but as far as what, you know, a La Niña would mean for precipitation, it's really hit or miss, and it may be like last year where it's elevation dependent as far as how much snow falls.
It is easy to forget that in Anchorage, we had little to no snow last winter, but mm-hmm. at Alyeska, south of us, they actually had to close the upper part of the ski resort because mm-hmm. of too much snow one day, which mm-hmm. Was very unusual to have to close down a ski resort because there was too much snow. So it sort of stalled out, it seemed, as it got to the mountains or warmed up. What was happening there?
Well, it was the flow. There was more low pressure. The position of the low pressure in the Gulf of Alaska sent the winds in a trajectory where it really funneled a lot of moisture on the lee side of the mountains, but then on the on the windward side, but then on the lee side, the other side of the mountains, the airflow moving down really dries it out, and so a lot of it was just the trajectory and the wind pattern. Like Turnagain Pass, they had a big snow year, a lot of snow up there for the snow machiners and the skiers, and even Hatcher's Pass and Arctic Valley here in Anchorage, they got in on the snow action as well. But again, based on the trajectory of the winds, it just really dried out when it came right over the ridge line and here in town and a lot of areas on that side of the mountains.
It was quite convenient for driving in the city, that's for sure. Anchorage just recorded its warmest month on record. July was 4 degrees above normal, with an average temperature of nearly 63 degrees. You, Brian, posted a map on Facebook a couple of days ago looking at the chance of warm temperatures that could still hit us. I think you posted that there's a 10% chance that the highest temperature of the year is still possible in Alaska, much higher percentage in the lower 48. It's starting to feel like fall to me. Can this really happen?
Well, now that so July was the warmest month on record for Anchorage and also for Kenai. And so it was the warmest July and also the warmest of any month. Now, if you set the warmest July, there's a good chance it's going to be your warmest of any month because July is going to typically be your warmest month. And then that, of course, not was only true of Anchorage. It was true, I mean, globally. Globally, July was the warmest July on record, and it was the warmest month on record, according to NASA, going back to 1880. So that, you know, just the warmth is everywhere. In some places, it's more intense than others. As far as the map you're referring to, that was more of an individual day. So it is, you know, I think the highest temperature in Anchorage this year has been 79. So is there, you know, what's the historical likelihood of the hottest day of the summer being after this date? It's pretty low in Alaska. In some places, they've never experienced their warmest day of the season after this date. So we tend to cool off. We reach our seasonal peak a little earlier here in Alaska. In fact, the eastern, central and eastern interior Alaska reached their summer temperature peak on average earlier than any part of North America, save parts of Arizona and New Mexico. So it's August is definitely the time of the year where temperatures really start to not plummet. That's more September and October, but they're definitely on the down slope. Mm-hmm.
So here a question for both of you, Rick in Fairbanks and Brian here in Anchorage. This record-breaking July, how do you see this as the climate scientists, as experts that look at these things in long-term range? Is it a blip, or is it sort of something that we can expect to see a lot more of in future Julys? How quickly are these things becoming more the normal rather than the outliers?
Well, I'll take a stab at it first. The last few years have been exceptionally warm in Alaska, and even more warmer by comparison to normal in Alaska than most places on the globe. So is this the new normal? I would say probably not. These are outliers for the most part, but they're more likely to occur now than they would be, say 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. So, if you were to 50 years ago, if you were to say, would we have this temperature in July? I would say that the probability is extremely low. But if you were to ask me last year, I would say it's much higher, that perhaps not likely, but much higher. So, the warming atmosphere really makes warm records much easier to attain. Rick?
So I think it's important to remember, any one month, when we're talking climate, we're talking several decades at least, preferably even longer than that. So one month is just a tiny part of that. But what's been particularly outstanding in Alaska and really much of the high latitudes has been the persistence of this warmth. It's been significantly warmer than average over much of Alaska most of the time since June of 2013. Now, Brian is certainly correct that is this the new normal? Is this going to continue unabated? Certainly not. But this long duration, 1 month doesn't mean much. 3+ years. Now we're starting to talk about a significant fraction of, for instance, we typically use 30 years as a normal period in climate work. Well, 3 years is now 10% of that. So we're starting to talk about really climatologically meaningful times, and it's really quite amazing. Is it going to stay like this in perpetuity? No, but this kind of warmth that we've had, both summer and winter, early snow melts and early breakups, these are much more likely in a warming world than they were in the mid-20th century.
All right. Well, thanks for that. We are going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we'll take some more calls and questions as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal Housing Lender, Member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and our guests today are climate experts. Brian Brettschneider is in the studio with me in Anchorage, and Rick Toman is in the studio of KUAC in Fairbanks. Let's go back to the phones quickly in our final minutes here. Bob is not in Thornton Bay. Well, he probably is in Thornton Bay, but he's not on the phone right now. So we are going to go now to Ty in Anchorage. Hi, Ty.
Hi, hello.
Do you have a question?
Yes, just an open-minded question, if you will. I've always been kind of curious, in a sense, just because in science, even in high school, they always taught us that, the Earth was very warm, and then there was an incident that caused a cooling, whether it was a meteor or volcanoes. And it's just, I've always been curious why we wouldn't expect the Earth to kind of more return back to that climate, and for it not, you know, to do so quicker, as in the sense, you know, ice in a cup, just as ice, you know, thaws, everything else starts kind of warming up quicker.
Well, I think, you know, I think perhaps what you're getting at is, you know, as things change over time, and you've correctly noted, you know, over, when we talk over hundreds of thousands, millions of years, you know, the temperature has gone up and down, and there have been times where, you know, there were forests, you know, in high latitudes, and things were warmer. I think it's important to keep in mind human timescales. And, you know, so I get questions sometimes. People say, well, yeah, you know, it was a record warm July, but you know, the Earth is 4.6 billion years old. And, you know, my response is, well, that is correct. But in terms of human timescales, and in terms of, you know, civilization, and also ecological timescales, you know, these variations are significant. And will, you know, will the climate revert back to a, you know, a pre-industrial human adapted or pre-industrial revolution state? You know, undoubtedly it will, but that may be in hundreds of thousands of years, or tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. And what would the Earth look like in the meantime as we get back to a new, you know, a pre-equilibrium? Might there be 90% less plant and animal species? Might there be, you know, no human species? So, you know, so these things do matter even on non-geologic timescales.
So you're saying just more in general, just we have to kind of look at it more just something relative to our experience, not just really the entire experience of the Earth's time.
Yeah, I think it is important to look at it in terms of our experience, because we, you know, we make decisions on the stewardship of the Earth based on human timescales and our own experiences and the things that we have control over.
All right,
absolutely,
Ty.
And I agree with all that. Thank you.
Thanks, Ty. Thanks for the question. Let's go to Eleanor quickly in Manicotic. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi. I wanted to say something about chemtrails. I listened to a documentary where jet streams were causing hurricanes and tornadoes. And, you know, the pollutions that are putting dirt ashes on icebergs are melting them. And we have at least 8 discs flying over us in a 24-hour day. And it's burning up the trees, the twigs, they're breaking off and stuff. And we can notice that we're kicking.
Eleanor, we're having a hard time understanding you. I think you had a question, sort of a follow-up on the chemtrails issue. Brian, anything more to say about that?
Not really. There's really no evidence that anything from above, that's been added to the atmosphere, is at least by humans, is changing the climate. I mean, if you want to talk about volcanic aerosols, you know, and maybe a soot on ice and glaciers and sea ice, that would perhaps be another discussion. I'm not sure she was really getting at that.
Okay. Thanks, Eleanor, for the call. Sorry we were having a hard time understanding you. Might be a cell phone issue. I wanted to ask a question about climate models and how accurate are... I know that the modeling has gotten better and better as more information is put in. How accurate would the two of you say they are now? Is what we're seeing matching up with what was predicted, and going forward, how confident are you that these models are getting much better at what's being predicted?
Well, there's a couple of timescales that are important. You know, one is, you know, if you're modeling, you know, the climate for this coming winter, or now another question would be, you're modeling what the climate will be like over the next 100 or next 1,000 years. Okay, and so those are. You know, two different types of algorithms and models. One's going to be more dynamical. One might be more statistical. But you know, I have a lot of confidence that the models are getting the big picture correct. You know, there's always issues with how it handles certain variables, cloud cover, soil moisture, and how many levels, what the resolution is. But you know, they seem to be doing a really good job on the big pictures, on the patterns. Rick?
Rick, please.
Yeah, certainly on the shorter time scales, say for this winter or perhaps as far out as next summer, especially in the at high latitudes for Alaska and the in the north. Climate models have done extremely well, but even in the mid latitudes, especially for temperature, there is significant skill. So by that I mean better than just a random guess, or better than just what you would expect from the long-term average. Precipitation, on the other hand, is a very different story. That precipitation varies greatly at small scales, as we've discussed, and that's a much more difficult forecast, and the models have a long way to go with the precipitation. But temperatures at the seasonal and annual scale are remarkably good.
Well, we have about 1 minute left, and we started the program by talking a bit about this huge storm that's in the Arctic, maybe chewing up sea ice. What is the sea ice extent right now, and what's it looking like for a prediction for the fall?
Well, it's low, and typically the seasonal minimum on sea ice is about the second week of September, so we got about 4 weeks to go. And so this is a really important time for the sea ice, and a big storm could really do a lot of damage to it. Before this storm, the prediction was it would be in the top, or in the bottom two or three of the satellite era, so since 1979, for the sea ice minimum. Not a record, and maybe not the second place, but certainly in that bottom tier. And again, it remains to be seen if this storm might drop it closer down to that 2012 all-time record low.
Rick, anything you'd like to add about predictions for sea ice extent this fall and what we're looking at going forward here?
Well, I think Brian's exactly right, but I would point out that we don't want to get hung up on, you know, exactly is it the lowest or the second lowest. Mm-hmm. We continue to be on this very steep downward trend compared to what we had prior to, say, 1990. It's whether this is the first, second, third, fourth, the trend is unmistakable, and that's just a part of the new reality we live in.
All right. Thank you so much to my guests, climatologist Brian Brettschneider in the studio in Anchorage, Rick Toman, NOAA climatologist in the studio at KUAC. Thanks to our partners at KUAC and to our engineer, Dave Waldron, and Wesley Early on phones. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for joining us.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to AlaskaCleanHarbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.